Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Everyone Has a Story. My name is John Caruso. This is the podcast that complements the quarterly lifestyle magazines Hello Sunshine and In Noosa Magazine. Spring issues of both of those titles out on the streets right now. And if you'd like your brand and your business to be part of our next issue, our summer issue, which is a big bumper issue for both of those titles, reach out to our client service managers or our team via Facebook and Instagram. Okay, on with today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. My next guest says he disappointed his father when he made the decision not to take over the family's farm in rural Victoria. Instead, a career in aviation lay ahead, and these days my guest is one of the founders of Sunshine & Sons on the Sunshine Coast. He says that the business is not a transaction business, it's a relationships business. And in this episode, we'll hear how a major supermarket chain helped the startup find its feet. Everyone has a story, and today I'd like you to meet Matt Hobson. I know a little bit about you, but I don't know a great deal about you, Matt. Where did you grow up? Where's home for you?
Yeah, well, I'm a farm boy through and through. I grew up in East Gippsland in country Victoria, renowned for rolling green paddocks and lots of dairy cows. We weren't on a dairy farm, but we certainly did have beef cattle. My father's he turned 80 this year and he's still on that farm or series of farms. I think one of the things I enjoy about living here on the Sunshine Coast is that vivid green that was part of my childhood is a real part of everything that you see here on the coast, despite the different climates.
I have those romantic thoughts as well, Matt, of rolling green hills and having some kind of Queenslander up on the top with a wraparound veranda, and there's cattle and cows grazing in the field below. It all sounds really romantic. Can I ask you, I'm also the son of a farmer. Was there an expectation? My dad was a sugarcane farmer in Bundaberg in Queensland. Was there an expectation for you to take over the reins on the farm, Matt?
Oh, absolutely. And it wasn't a happy period of our father-son relationship as I was, again, slowly, but over time, making that transition away from a life on the land and in the family business. It was a real point of contention. My sister was less inclined to be involved in the farm, so certainly there was a focus from a very young age on continuing in my father's and generations of his family. They were white settlers right at the beginning of modern European settlement in that area of Australia. So that was a little awkward, and I remember as I was making that transition and probably putting it into context, Dad's a man of few words and still is, but he's certainly of a big focus on actions. And one of the first steps was moving out of the family farm, pursuing a career at the local airport, which I'll come to that part of my early career a little later. But when I was asking him, and he was willing to help me with some renovations on a very small, effectively an apartment, but I got a whopping big bill as he left. It wasn't a love job.
Your dad.
Absolutely. I remember it vividly. I was, like all young people, I was probably at that stage, hadn't yet turned 18, and there wasn't a lot of money in the bank. Yeah, it was as Dad left with, again, he was a very handy man. He's also a builder. He left with having done some great work that I'd helped him with, but he was certainly letting me know that if you were going to make your own way in life, that you were going to have to pay your own bills.
You mentioned a sister. Were there any other siblings, for example, another brother or brothers that could have taken over the farm, Matt?
No, there was not. There was only my sister, Sarah. She's an accountant in Perth, having had a long and continuing career in the mining sector. So, but yeah, she wasn't the outdoors type. And yeah, so there wasn't anyone else to hand over the reins, and subsequently Dad's remained on the farm, but there's certainly, as he's got older, there's less of a focus of generating revenue from the properties.
When it was that this kind of time, you're in your teens or whatever, and these issues or discussions came up about you taking the farm over, was farming a good business to be in at the time? I ask that question because, unlike you and your dad, my dad is a sugarcane farmer. The sugarcane industry wasn't doing well in the early to mid 80s. And for me, as the son of a sugarcane farmer, my dad always said, don't end up on the farm. They were his words that still ring in my ears today. Was it a prosperous time on the farm? And is that why your dad was a bit annoyed, because things were well and you didn't want to be part of it? Or was it, were there other reasons?
Oh, I think the really dad's focus on family and heritage, which was and continues to be a big part of our family. It was that reality that if your only son is not going to continue, that sense of loss, I think, has probably characterised his interests and at that time a disappointment in not continuing. There's properties in that area that literally date back to the squatocracy, where land grants were given to some of the big property grants that were given to individuals from the Crown. I think when in the context of well over 150 years at that point of ongoing involvement with those properties for that to be dawning, that was literally the end of the line. Now, he still discusses that with me regularly of the what next. He approaches his life very much on the basis that he's going to live forever. We have had discussions of the what next, which are yet to be determined with that land. But I think, again, the local Aboriginal people certainly have that belonging and ownership of land. I know it's seen and discussed quite differently in regards to European settlement, but Dad's passion and belonging on that space and on that place in the universe continues to be strong and flavours his views.
Wow. You mentioned he just turned 80. Is he still on that parcel of land there, Matt?
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's several thousand acres, which for Victoria is...
Wow.
That's a very large land holding for private individuals.
Yeah.
Given the nature of farming in that region. He's still very active. Having turned 80, you certainly wouldn't know that he's as active today as I can recall in my youth. Certainly maybe a little older and creakier, but certainly gets on with all of the things that are on his to-do list.
Good on him. He's got a purpose. I mean, I understand my dad kept 5 acres off the sugarcane farm where he grew 120, had 120 mango trees, and for him, that was his purpose for getting out of bed every morning. You know, otherwise, I think he'd probably feel a bit lost. And I sense your dad's the same. He has a purpose to get out of bed, and that still drives him. Matt, you mentioned the airport. Were you always into aviation and planes? Is that what you were thinking and dreaming of as a kid?
Quite the opposite. It wasn't an involvement, and certainly my career went on to over 30 years within aviation and airlines. But as a kid, I was certainly interested in aeroplanes, but they weren't something that I had ever felt was within reach. We weren't a family that holidayed via the use of domestic or international air transport. I'd certainly started a career in aviation before I took my first flight as a passenger on an aeroplane, to give you some context of my childhood, which certainly, again, how quickly things change, I don't think was enormously unusual in the 70s and early 80s. There was a lot of people that potentially hadn't taken a flight in any context. So
I'm the same. It was many, many years. I think it was in my late teens or maybe early 20s before I jumped on the plane. So what was that? You said you started a career in aviation before taking... What were you doing, Matt?
Well, I'd been exposed to, in that era of Victorian education, there was high schools and technical schools that were providing secondary education through the state education system. The technical schools were effectively a hybrid of a high school and a TAFE, a vocational training education for particularly apprentices. And I was followed in my father's footsteps attending that same school, a school called Sale Technical School, which no longer exists. It was amalgamated back into the high schools in the early 90s. But I had a very passionate teacher that was, and again, a great guy called Mr. Monahan. One of the projects we undertook was building and constructing a gas turbine engine. So imagine if you're a 15-year-old boy suddenly assisting machining and designing and modifying from a blueprint, very old-fashioned blueprint, a big roll of paper that rolled out with all these intricate drawings. And that fascinated me and certainly caught my imagination. It was something that working in that level of detail, very different from helping out on the farm and with my father, that accuracy and intricacy really, really caught my imagination as a child. Growing into a young man, subsequently I had the opportunity to, through work experience, do some work with a local business that had just started operating on a small airport, a small regional airport, and that engine was business, was a effectively an engine maintenance facility for light aircraft. Again, had all of that accuracy and precision that I'd enjoyed throughout my secondary education. That quickly blossomed into a career and an apprenticeship and university education.
What was your title and what kind of planes were you working on?
Aircraft maintenance engineer mechanical. Yeah, which was my studies were at the RMIT University in Melbourne. Over many years. And again, I look back at that period of my life, again, some awkwardness transitioning from the expectation of farming, but really passionate about what I was doing and seeing things effectively maintained, problems solved, processes developed and met, some very exciting things that really, it was something I was very good at and had lots of opportunities present as a result. No different in my current choice of career, that work that is a joy isn't really work at all. So, and then that certainly characterised that period of learning a profession in an aviation context, which was all new.
Yeah, I can hear you talking about the way you talked about the plans and the blueprints and unfolding those detailed, intricate maps or whatever. And I'm getting that you're a real attention to detail, investigation of the finer details of things, how things work, how things are put together. How does that translate to what you're doing now?
Well, it's a lot of the interest in a very different context. With Sunshine and Sons brand is a consumer good. That's not a sector I've ever been involved in up until 2019, when myself and my business partner, Michael Conrad, started the business. But it has some similarities in that when you're presenting what we're aiming to be a very beautiful and premium product, those intricate steps along the way to get something that consumers are as passionate about as we are is very exacting. There's countless steps along the way to get to that point, and it does have some parallels to, albeit a different outcome. One is obviously very mechanical, is operated in a very high risk environment with the challenges of aviation. A consumer good has as many moving parts in it, the relationships that are needed to get a product from concept to a shelf and thereafter into a consumer's hands are very intricate. Every day waking up with the challenges within our business is again a joy, because those things are something that I love being involved in, and I love seeing come to fruition after all of those intricate steps and challenges along the way. Certainly wouldn't have it any other way, John.
Talk to me about that career path now. So from working, I guess that first job was in Victoria, from working on aircraft engines in Victoria to running Sunshine and Sons and producing the products that you're producing today. I know pathway develop?
Well, throughout aviation, I've never said no to a challenge. So when I look at again, we're all a product of the choices we make and potentially don't make. The opportunities that present that we say no to is equally important in our lives. I had a desire to see the world and skills that were developing that I was able to take advantage of opportunities that presented and jump in almost all circumstances into roles and opportunities that were beyond certainly my proven ability at that stage, because they're all growing into new roles with different responsibilities and greater responsibilities for the most part. That was something that really benefited on in later in life when I had opportunities back in Australia after many years of working internationally, that I was having the ability to take on roles with Australian businesses that were very demanding, but again, came with great opportunities to develop and learn. That career in the airline world And having left that, I feel a little sad because I'm as passionate today about the airline industry than I've ever been. But it was certainly the time that all of that experience and development for other businesses, it was certainly my driving belief that it was approaching the time that it was time for me to develop a business of my own and have the opportunity to work with people and employ people within a business that I was shaping and grow and develop people in much the same way as I'd had the opportunity with others during my airline career.
And was producing a gin or operating and running a distillery, was that clear? Like, when did that idea become clear to you, Matt?
Well, I had a lot of business acquaintances that were heavily involved in craft brewing. Again, probably like lots of Australian men and women, always keen for a good beer. And again, one of the difference between growing up as a young man with some mainstream beer being really the only option at the very beginning of myself turning 18 and being able to drink, seeing the development and really those exquisite products that have shaped craft beer in Australia. It was something that I'd noticed, and as a consumer was spending money proving that was something I was passionate and interested in. Certainly craft distilling, I certainly believe that having travelled the world and seen what was happening overseas, there was a real big opportunity. There's certainly some players in Australia that had started that journey. I think Four Pillars Gin's a great example. They were not that old, but it really shaped consciousness of Australian consumers that when you're drinking a spirit, there's no reason that you have to buy a commodity product produced by a multinational company. You can certainly support local businesses and get some exquisite products that are going to surprise and delight quality and premium nature of those spirits.
What are the differences that set your product apart from, because it seems like there's a bit of a boom with the production of gin.
We have to work very hard on our point of difference to attract consumers. We're entwined with the Sunshine Coast. We are a Sunshine Coast through and through. We work very hard on incorporating wherever we can the elements that people are attracted to be living or visiting the Sunshine Coast. That imagery, the brand framework that we use, and certainly the quality and premium nature of our ingredients. We want people to, when they're having a drink, to drink better, as often the analogy used in craft spirits. We're not, nor are other distilleries, wanting people to drink more. We're really wanting people to come on that journey to drink better. We want people to feel that when they're having our spirits or enjoying our spirits on a social occasion, that they're able to feel that they're part of the Sunshine Coast. We're using some very premium ingredients that are absolutely distinctive when people are enjoying our products, that they can relate to that feeling of why the Sunshine Coast is a premium place to be.
When you talk about ingredients, Matt, are they called botanicals? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, certainly in our gin range, we are using botanicals.
Yeah.
Gin, by definition, is a flavoured vodka, including the use of a botanical, being an organic vegetative ingredient. Juniper is grown on conifer trees. It's a small, sappy berry.
Yeah.
That gives gin the distinctive taste of gin. Although our juniper berries aren't grown on the Sunshine Coast, given the climate that is required for successfully growing distilling-grade junipers, we use other local ingredients. And our Pineapple Pathway Gin is a great example of that. That's soon to be, it will be launched for the Big Pineapple's 50th birthday. We're a 10 in Alvin and a neighbour of our big fiberglass monolith here at Wumbai. Our Pineapple Parfait Gin is celebrating those beautiful pineapple parfait desserts that the Sunshine Plantation was famous for throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s. We're using some amazing local pineapple, strawberry, mango, passion fruit, vanilla and coconut to really, again, just to work on that point of difference that people want to be, well, people love to be wowed, and we love to wow them with that local connection to the products.
Yeah.
Consumer spending and sentiment, is absolutely about loving local. And they want to know who's making their product. They want to know how it's being made, and that consumers are being rewarded, because there is opportunities out there to do that. And visitors to our distillery door can absolutely see and be part of the process that brings those beautiful spirits to life.
I want to pick your business brain now. So having started this business, how do you grow the business? How do you get your brand out into the market? What strategies did you guys implement to grow that brand awareness?
Well, I think one of the things we remind ourselves all of the time, that despite the emphasis on transactions, we're not a transactions business. We're a relationship business. Our strength is our people, and the strength of our people is their ability to form and evolve and work with other people to build relationships that we can see our beautiful products have the commercial success that they deserve, both at a direct-to-consumer point of sale, and so visitors to our distillery door, or our growing online presence. And equally important for us is we absolutely have a retail focus. We want to see, we spare no expense in getting our products visible in the market. Our packaging is, it's very hard to be objective, but my own view and what's reinforced when we talk to the people in Australian trade and commerce that make the big decisions of what brands are the up-and-comers, our packaging is absolutely premium. People really love to see those bottles on their bar at home or sharing with their friends. Simply in all of those efforts to get our products sold and to generate revenue to build our business, we absolutely come back all the time, John, that it's all about relationships. Without relationships, the transactions aren't going to grow.
I like that. It sounds, you know, the more of those businesses you hear of that are, you know, the way you put it, it's not transactional, but it's relationship. It's really laying those foundation stones to building a great business. Businesses and brands are always about super serving those loyal customers, not just necessarily about trying to get more and more and more. But if you look after each and every individual, if you super serve those clients, you're always going to build on that great foundation. How far, you're a local business here on the coast. You mentioned that you're close to the big pineapple there on the way to Nambour. How far do you send or export your products, Matt?
Well, we're not exporting currently. We're really focused on developing, certainly on the Sunshine and Sons brand. We're wanting that. We're very passionate about having this as the spirit of choice on the Sunshine Coast. We're very focused on success locally. So the vast majority of our engagement with community, and we are very active in the not-for-profit and charity space, supporting events and organisations. We are retailed through the both of the big majors and the independents in the Australian retailing of liquor. So you will find our products all the way down to Hobart, all the way up to Cairns. We have less penetration in South Australia and WA and Northern Territory currently, but subject to some further developments in our business, we're absolutely hoping that will be the case. But the export is something in the future. Like all small businesses have the reality that our resources and finances are limited, and we have to very carefully step through the growth of our business to make sure that growth is sustainable. And certainly export in the current world climate, through circumstances such as COVID, again, with reference to that focus on relationships in our business, it requires some novel approaches to developing relationships.
Sure.
Typically, spirits are sold face to face, often with a handshake. Clearly, that's problematic currently.
Yeah, well, for Cairns to Hobart, that's a pretty good effort for a relatively new brand. I like what you said before. Spirits are generally sold face to face, often with a handshake.
Well, I think it's a challenge in our products were available for sale in March of 2020, and we had some beautiful bottles sitting in our distillery. We were very proud. There was a lot of effort from a lot of people to get to that point. But we were certainly confronted with the reality that traditional method of building relationships and confidence in your products with over a drink or a culminating in a handshake simply wasn't possible due to circumstances from COVID. Again, fortunate that retailers in particular, given the absolute inability to deal with any of the on-premise trade, which is our pubs, clubs and bars, they really embraced local at that point in time to overcome some of that, what would have been a real difficulty in people having the confidence to basically support a brand new brand with bottles on retail shelves. Now, we were very proud during that period, reflecting the quality of the people that are part of our business. Our first orders were from Woolworths. They're Woolworths-owned Dan Murphy's and BWS. So we sort of went from zero to hero in a real hurry. We certainly had some, we didn't have enormous financial reserves at that point in time to get to production. We'd spent many millions of dollars on equipment set up in the distillery, reflecting our long-term desires to be a very significant player in the space that we're operating. But we were certainly very pleased where the Woolworths group really embraced local and the orders that came through thick and fast prior to the end of June 2020 were really the difference between our business still being here, to be perfectly honest, John. It was without that support from one of Australia's big majors, it's quite possible that our business would not have survived.
Matt Hobson from Sunshine and Sons, he was my guest on today's episode of Everyone Has a Story. If you enjoyed that, if you'd like to share the episode about with family and friends and other social media friends, please do so on your social media networks. Until next time, take care.